This podcast is brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Clare Valley Podcast, highlighting the news, issues and events in the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. I'm your host, Annabelle Homer. Coming up, autumn. It's a wonderful time in the valley with the changing colours of the landscape, winter coats and beanies, sipping red wine by the roaring wood fire. And of course, at this time of year is the highlight of the local tourism industry calendar, the annual Clare Valley SCA Gourmet Week, a time to celebrate all things the Clare Valley has to offer: fine wine, delicious food, the entertainment, the fully immersive Clare Valley experience. You'll get a taste of gourmet later on in the episode. Also, we'll take a look at the region's housing shortage. It's no secret, it's critical, with no rentals available and no land to develop. It's a problem nationwide. But Council here has just released their own housing report, looking at some resolutions to secure more land for housing and in turn boost growth in the region. But first, to the latest news out of Council headquarters, I'm joined by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council CEO, Dr. Helen McDonald. First and foremost, any more developments or any decisions made on the budget, the long-term financial plan? Because that's what we talked about in depth in the last podcast.
Unfortunately, no. Having fulfilled Council's request to provide a draft budget which showed a 7% rate, so that would be on the income side, but then to
a 7% rate increase?
Yes, and then cut the deficit to $1.5 million. Which we did do, and we listed the range of areas that had been cut so that the councillors had an idea, and we also in the report explained some of the consequences of those cuts so that council could be fully aware of the implications of the decisions they're making. So,
and it's quite a list of things that would be cut if you needed to meet that 1.5.
Indeed. It's quite significant, and as I normally do, we focus most of our attention as far as we could on those non-mandated services, so things that are not listed in the Local Government Act that local government has to provide. Unfortunately, to meet council's requirement to get to a 1.5 deficit, we did have to cut into road maintenance, stormwater maintenance, building maintenance, etc. So there was some significant, because they are the largest part of our budget, so there were some significant cuts to those areas as well. We delivered to council what they required. Not sure that they were entirely comfortable with the things that we had cut out, but it's a bit difficult if they want to reduce the deficit to not make some pretty hefty cuts to the budget. I mean, it's not, unfortunately, like everybody else, council's feeling the impact of inflation, increases in electricity prices, increases in diesel, etc. They all impact our running costs.
And when you start cutting services, as you said, in the long term, it's going to counteract that, because if you start not maintaining buildings, etc., it all starts to catch up down the track anyway.
It does. I mean, it's one thing to cut some of the non-mandated services because they're not around maintenance. They're generally around things like donations or sponsorships and things like that. But when you have to go further, and if you're then having to cut your maintenance budget, that will have a long-term impact on council, because it means that your assets are not being maintained to their optimal level, and therefore there's a good chance that the life of that asset before it needs to be renewed or replaced will be shortened.
So with this information that council now has, was there any decision then of, did they renegotiate or rethink 1.5 deficit?
No, there was no decisions forthcoming from council. The only decision that they made with respect to the budget was to have another workshop. We had a workshop scheduled for the 31st of May, which we'll go ahead with that, and hopefully we will be able to get a decision from them.
And if there's no decision, say by the end of the end of the financial year, does administration just go forward with their budget? Is that what happens?
No, it's not. So if council doesn't approve a budget, they do have until August. I can't remember exactly the date, but they do have until August to make that decision. However, obviously, I am pushing for a 1st of July, or to have a decision before the 1st of July, because every day that you push past that means that where we've got work that needs to be attended, we can't move forward with that because if we don't know what we can deliver, we can't start drawing up tenders, we can't advertise tenders. So it means that the 12-month period that you have to deliver your work, every moment that the council is unable to make a decision, it delays in your capacity to deliver the services that they do decide they want delivered. I mean, council will still continue, but it just means that we won't be doing very much, that's all.
So a 7% increase in rates, just refresh my memory, what was the increase in rates in the last financial year?
I think it was 4.95. Don't hold me to that. I'd have to double check. But yes, even a 7% rate increase doesn't actually cover costs because inflation for March, which is the figure that we use, was 7.9. And so strictly speaking, if you're going to cover your costs, you should be increasing your costs by inflation plus or CPI plus growth. And although growth is not a significant number in our council at the moment, but it is the way in which local government normally proceeds is CPI plus growth.
Do you know what other councils are increasing or flagging that they're increasing their rates by?
From the metro councils that I've heard, most of them are up around 8%. There's some regional councils that I've heard that are talking about 5%. So, yeah, it really depends on the services that you have to deliver.
And differential rates will be increasing along the same line as well, I presume?
No, differential is a decision that has to be taken annually. And strictly speaking, to use a differential, you have to have a very good reason, not that you've just used it before. The differential was certainly discussed during the council meetings. There appears to be some interest in reducing the primary production differential.
Okay, watch this space.
Indeed.
Moving on to waste collection, and how is the FOGO waste collection going after its implementation?
Well, pretty good. So we went through the month of March and then got to April where the community were 100% clean in their FOGO bin. So we managed to have every truckload of FOGO waste that was taken to Inkerman actually accepted. So goes to Pete's Soils. And it was accepted. So we had no rejections. That means that the Clare and Gilbert Valleys community did not have to pay for that contaminated waste to go to landfill. As I've mentioned before, every truckload of waste that goes to landfill, the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council has to pay the state government a tax. If you don't want to pay tax, keep your bins clean.
Any other issues still coming out of that waste situation?
Well, I think there's still room for people to better understand what is waste and what's recyclable. You know, where people don't feel like they've got enough capacity in the little red bin with their waste, they probably should have a really good think and try and better understand what are recyclables, because from what we can see, there's still a fair amount of recyclables going into the waste bin that could go into the black body bin, which would help people in terms of their capacity and also help generally, because every truckload that goes to the landfill sites, it costs us not just the cost you pay for general waste collection, but it's an added cost on top of that, which council has to absorb.
What's the update on the Clare Caravan Park water park?
Well, I was in communications with Discovery over the last couple of months, first, you know, asking them what was their plan, when did they think things were going, and their first response was, it's got to go to the board. And I came back after that, and my understanding from them is that the Discovery Board, has approved the expenditure of money to do the upgrades for the water park, and I think there's other upgrades that they want to make to the caravan park. So their expectations that will proceed and be done by Christmas. Having said that, they still have to have their development approvals. They have to have development and building approvals. So they've done the first step, but they keep moving around the plans they have, where they want to put things, where they want to place things. And obviously they're thinking about the amenities and co-related and how it will work together, and so have changed their mind about a few of those things. I think they have to have that before they can obviously start doing any construction work. All indications I have is that it will be done by this Christmas.
Has the Riverton Light Gallery got any volunteers now, just so we can see that gallery open up a lot more than just once a month?
We have got a handful of volunteers, and I think my understanding is that Alison and Alfie are going to allow it to be open, I think, 2 days a week. Shout out for those arty people or people that really love the arts, if they'd like to give up an afternoon. It's only a few hours a month. We'd really appreciate to hear from them, because if we can get that gallery open and get it open consistently, I think, yeah, it will become part of the tourist trek.
Another issue that was discussed at the latest council meeting was the local housing shortage. It's no secret there are no rentals available in the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council, and if there is, the waiting list is pretty significant. There's very few houses to buy and not much land to develop. Earlier this year, the state government launched its own plan to resolve the housing crisis across South Australia. Implementing the Office for Regional Housing, created within Renewal SA, to identify the housing challenges and opportunities in the region, as well as a key worker housing scheme to help regions that have growth but have nowhere to house their workers. A pilot program has been launched, but not in this region. Recently, the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council did their own housing report, identifying key issues and came up with their own resolutions that need to be addressed. Council CEO Dr. Helen McDonald.
Council itself, as part of the review it's done of housing, is to come up with a number of options, and I think there were about five or six, and they selected three, two which were to do with the release of land. So some of it's community land, so go through the revocation process so that it can be freehold and sold as freehold blocks. So there's some land in Clare that's been identified where that could take place.
Whereabouts? Can you be specific?
In Phoenix Avenue, near Melrose Park. And then there's also a resolution which is about us looking where there might be other land which could become housing development. So basically trying to increase the pipeline of opportunities for development. And then on top of that, there was a resolution which is providing incentive to developers that do sort of multiple developments, so where they've got land and so they subdivide it and get it onto the market. So it's about encouraging subdivision and getting housing blocks onto the market. So there's some incentives there to encourage that step to be taken.
In past episodes, we've talked about the prefab homes.
Yeah.
And was that actually part of the report as well? Prefabrication homes, because that's even been considered on a state national level as well.
Yeah, it's a huge opportunity. And in fact, I was reading something, it was either in The Guardian or something like that, about prefabricated housing and how it's no longer like the 1950s Housing Commission houses, which were, you know, shocking bills, really cold. But now it's, you know, very trendy, very sophisticated and sustainable. Mm. I think that's the really big thing. It's about sustainability. And it's also much faster because they can be done in a factory situation and then just delivered in generally in modules to a site, and then the installation period is really quick. Council didn't specifically look at that or discuss it. That the discussions we'd had before was in relation to potentially identifying some housing or land where we could have some low-cost housing established fairly quickly. So, no, that wasn't followed up.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that was your prime motive, is to identify land, and that was the more serious or priority, when can there be some movement on that?
Oh, I think that's just an ongoing thing. I mean, we've already identified some land. There's land that's owned by the state government, which we've talked to them about, in fact, numerous times for at least 6 months, and that should be released onto the market hopefully soon in one way or the other.
Not, where's that?
That's in Clare. And that's usually quite a longish process to have land, because they have to go through the land revocation process as well. Although, if my memory's correct, that's actually freehold land, so that could happen quite quickly. So we will basically, or the planning staff will need to go and look a number of where there's potential opportunities, but also rezoning. So rezoning existing land to be potential for expanding urban development, whether it's in Riverton or Clare or some of the other smaller places. I mean, obviously, there's Watervale that's potentially coming onto the market as well.
Well, let's discuss that, the Watervale Code Amendment.
Yeah, so that's a private request, shall we say, so that there's some land just on the edge of Watervale that's been identified as being suitable for urban development or for...
Residential?
Residential, thank you very much. For residential development. So that was put to council as, you know, would they be supportive? And council was definitely supportive. At the end of the day, it's not council's decision. Code amendments are the responsibility of the state government. So it'll be the department, well, it's actually the minister that gets to sign off. And so that's really the code amendment will have to go through that process and eventually get to the minister's desk. So hopefully.
With developers, is there a demand from developers to develop in this region?
Not from the professional developers that are active in the city. Again, because of the return on their investment, they make more money working in metro areas as they do in regional areas. So, I mean, there's sort of homeowner builders. There's plenty of that. Yeah. But in terms of multiple developments, I mean, we do have a developer that has done some work here, but until he runs out of properties in sort of places like Mount Barker or, you know, the city, he'll defer more development here.
So I guess that's why you need those incentives then, to try and get them to come out to the regions in the first place. So more land is becoming available at Watervale. There was a motion for an incentive scheme to encourage more developers to come up to the regions. Anything else with that report that's worth mentioning?
I suppose the other thing to say about it is council took the view that it should just proceed slowly. It could have put in place quite a number of incentive schemes to encourage developers, but as was mentioned at least once or twice by the councillors, is council's not a developer and we need to, you know, be quite careful about how we proceed. But one of the things that we can do is rezone land and assist the process of more land or residential land coming onto the market. Mm. So there are some of the things we can do.
Let's go to the industry and find out how dire it really is. Mark Omar is principal of Ray White Clare Valley. He says the real estate and rental market is in uncharted waters here locally. During and post-COVID prices for sales and rentals rose substantially. And he says there's no signs of those prices returning to pre-COVID levels.
If we go back to January 2020 or February when COVID hit, there was a few months of nothing. And then the market, I think what happened across Australia, everywhere regionally, we can put it down to within 2 hours of a major airport, suddenly became hotspots all over Australia. So let's talk about Clare, a pretty hidden place in South Australia. And then it suddenly became a destination place because of its values. So people could buy cheap properties and come from the city, come to a place like Clare, buy a house for $500,000, great. And from that, what happened is then the prices went up. You know, we're talking 23% in 18 months in Clare on average.
Have you seen that happen before?
Never. I don't think it has, not that drastically. So what happened is Clare, traditionally, you're always relying on locals to buy and sell. So, and buyers always had the upper hand. So suddenly you're in a seller's market where we set a price and you'd want to pay that or over to be in the ballpark. You know, we were getting properties where you were having 10, 15 offers on a property. And we were getting East Coast money, which is a completely different scenario that Clare's never seen. So you're getting buyers from Melbourne, Brisbane, Sydney that are selling $2 or $3 million properties and coming over and seeing a property for $700,000 and going, I'm not even in a discussion with the price. That's the price. We're just buying it. We did a stat for the tourism committee 1 year where I think 2020 to 2021, 52% of the buyers were from out of town. So one in every two properties. We did 160 sales in that financial year and 80 of them were to people coming into the area or investing in the area.
So do you find if they're from out of town or out of the area that they have stayed and are living in the area or are they renting out?
I reckon there's a split maybe 60-40. So they've either bought it and have moved here, maybe 60% of the people, 40% are investors or they're Airbnb-ing until they do move here. Mm. So some of them have bought with a longer plan to come here eventually. So they're either renting or more Airbnb-ing them until that time.
So how many more Airbnbs are there?
I don't know the exact figure, but it's certainly jumped up maybe another 25%. We're off. Airbnbs, because everyone saw the occupancy rates go through the roof, some of them even converted their rentals into Airbnbs.
Mm. And that's the ongoing problem.
So suddenly you've got more people wanting to rent on the rental market, less properties on the market. Primarily, everyone that owns investment property in Clare, most of them don't live in Clare. Mm. You know, there's some, but a lot of them are from out of town. Some of them moved back to Clare during COVID, so that they took their investment property back, so there's less, and then there's Airbnbs.
There's this move to try and get Airbnbers to move their properties back into the rental market. How are you going to get people to do that?
Why would you? So,
but the rental market is through the roof. You can be charging quite a lot of money for rent. So wouldn't it be less work for an Airbnb?
Yep. But if I'm an Airbnb owner, and I don't disagree because I think the rental market, like, we need rentals. But if I've got a reliable cleaner and I'm charging $350 a night and your occupancy rates in Clare Valley is still, let's say it's conservatively at 75% of the year, that surely completely outweighs having a weekly rental. You know, and if they've got a mortgage on it, it just covers it plus some. The other thing, I guess, is if they suddenly change it from an Airbnb to a rental, you're relying on someone that wants it fully furnished. Otherwise, they've got to get rid of the furniture because they've got it all in there. So if you've got a tenant that's going in there, it's fully furnished already. So do they want that right down to the cutlery?
Yeah.
So then they've got to make the decision.
So what are the, what's the rental market like in Clare?
Well, you can't get a rental.
You still can't get a rental.
You can't get a rental. There's just waiting lists.
Is there?
Yeah, still. Probably not as bad as, say, this time last year. It's probably easing. There's more coming on the market, but there's certainly... Clare's a funny one for rentals because you have so many contracted work people, like hospital, school teachers. They're not going to buy traditionally because they're only here on 12-month contracts. Mm. They might extend. So they're all in the rental market. Plus, you've got all the people that are renters in a small population. So there's only so many... I guess there's only so many properties that are rentals.
What about at Riverton and Saddleworth and Burra? It's the same thing. There's no
everywhere.
Rentals there.
Everywhere, Burra, Balaclava. If you put a rental up in any of those towns, the most recent couple we've done in Balaclava, you know, you might have had 10 to 15 people through a rental still.
What's the prices? How much have they gone up by?
I reckon Clare, we're probably used to average across the board around 280 to 300, and that's probably more like 350 to 370. Your higher end stuff, you know, if you got $400 a week in Clare, that was a really good rental. Now we're talking 500, 550 because people...
For a family home?
For a family home. If you're, you know, it's a nice four-bedroom, two-bath, people will pay. And if businesses are wanting to rent them, they'll probably offer more to secure them because they can, you know, do it through the business. You know, there's so much infrastructure around the mid-north with wind farms and so on as well, man. It is still a really good time to invest, even now.
But you'll be paying in a high market.
You're paying in a high market, but how I see it now is you're paying in a high market where interest rates are at its highest. So that's only going to go backwards and the rental market's not. So even if you're paying at the top of the price now, the rental market's better and you'll eventually pay less interest. I don't know everything, but I reckon by the start of next year, we'll start seeing interest rate drops. So if you get through the worst now, you're fine.
The last few years for you must have been a fantastic time for a real estate
agent.
Really
good to be a real estate agent. Chaotic, blur. Yeah, they're the words we use, like just flat out. It's just about having the stock, if you could have the properties to sell. So we'll just complete our third straight financial year with over 100 sales in every financial year. It's just been...
That hasn't happened before.
No, like before that, 50 to 60 would be a really good year. So,
and do you think that trend is just going to continue?
There's no negatives around Clare Valley. It's stock levels now. You know, I look at it and go, well, the population we have, even if you look at the whole Gilbert Valley, there's only so many properties that can be sold. And then you've got to rely on resale.
So let's look at the stock. How do we get more houses in the Clare Valley? The council has said we need that there needs to an incentive needs to be provided to get developers to this area.
Yep.
Do you support that?
I do support it. The biggest issue is I don't think it's a developer issue or a real estate issue. It's a building issue. So you can get a developer. Traditionally in the past, developers have shied away because it's taken so long for land packages to sell, a bit better in the last couple of years. But now we're seeing land sit on the market because people know it's a two-year wait to build. Mm. And the building prices have gone through. So now it's actually cheaper to buy an established house than start from scratch. So if I'm a developer and I want to come to Clare, you're going to be holding that cost for a lot of years because, you know, if we're doing a land development, we expect it to be leveled, retained, services connected, street lights, everything's done. But then you're holding the cost of selling the blocks off. The problem with builders is it's not even their fault, really. It's then they wait for suppliers. So they've, you know, they put the slab down, but they've got to wait for the framework and that's great, but then they've got to wait for the windows. And it's just it's an ongoing thing. It sounds really negative. I mean, there's lots of houses getting built. And the builders, I think, are doing a really good job. It's just the backlog.
So if that all in mind,
yeah,
crystal ball gazing 5 years down the track, do you think it's all going to be all sorted out?
Yeah.
So this has never happened before, so no, uncharted territory.
We are. It's a guess, isn't it? So the benefit now we've got with Claire is the new price is the new price. When I don't think it's going to drop. I don't think it's going to get to a point where suddenly prices drop. This is the new, we plateau. Regional areas sort of, they get to a new price and then they just plateau. Interest will still come through. Interest rate rises haven't really affected the market.
Okay.
Maybe just at the high end slightly, but the mum and dad purchases up to $500,000 is not slowed down at all. I just think there's so much positivity for Claire. You know, and even, and I include all of the suburbs in that. Balaclava is a really, really popular market at the moment. Burra has always been popular. People fall in love with Burra, right down to Riverton and Auburn. Like, the benefit people see south is that they don't have to drive as far from Adelaide, so they've got their weekender in Auburn, maybe.
What about Ryanee, Tarlee and all those areas?
They all turn over.
Because Freeling went through a burn.
Freeling's gone through. Well, you look what's happening in Two Wells and Malala with all the land developments, right? So that's going to keep coming. I mean, it's not going to come right through to Balaclava, but that land sales just keeps moving. We all drive that way now because of roadwork. So we see what's happening in Two Wells.
It's huge.
It's just another extension of Adelaide now. So it keeps pushing people out where they go, okay, Malala and Two Wells are too expensive, so I might buy in Balaclava or Owen, and they go that way.
So that's why you think Balaclava's...
Yeah. Balaclava's always been really popular because it's a very big farming community. There's a lot of work there between there and Port Wakefield with abattoirs and chicken farms and all that. So it's always a market that moves pretty well.
Mark Omar, principal of Ray White Clare Valley. The Clare Valley has been heaving over the past week with all the music and food and wine celebrations for the Clare Valley Gourmet Week. Around 8,000 people attended the Clare Valley Gourmet Festival weekend, the first weekend. That doesn't even take into account all the events that have happened for the 7 days afterwards. Good news too for wineries, with some reporting crowd numbers were back to where they were pre-COVID. I decided to join the festivities and hit Eldridge Vineyards for its Family Fun Day. And so did many others from near and far. Let's just say everyone was in fine wine spirits and loving the vibe that the Clare Valley Gourmet event brings every year.
James Rusk from Glenelg. Been more than 10 years that my wife and I have been coming. It's a relaxed vibe, really. Food's reliable and the wine's brilliant.
Hello, I'm Megan Rusk. I'm from Glenelg. We've had a great weekend so far. We started off at Claymore's on Friday night. Yesterday we ventured out to Seven Hill, and today we're here at Eldridge having a great time.
And why is it that you decide to come back time and time again? It's been 10 years, James said, so why do you enjoy it so much?
Well, friends first and foremost. We live in Glenelg. We have a lot of friends that live here in Clare. Catching up with them, it's become a bit of an annual festival. So enjoy the good times, the wines, the variety, and I love how there's something different each year.
And what do you think about the fact that it's now a gourmet week opposed to just the weekend?
Well, controversial, because when it was first sort of told to us it was a week, we felt a bit left out because we can only come up for the weekend. But now that I've looked at the program, I think for the locals, it's just really giving so many options and pushing out that enjoyment over a whole week. So that's exciting for people that are here. And for us, we still just pack as much into the weekend as we can.
Travis Campbell from Clare.
So you're the head brewer at Pike's, but you're here at Eldridge's today. I mean, as a local, what's gourmet like for you?
I like these events because it's good to see friends, other locals out and about. I like seeing my beer poured at other places as well, which is great.
I'm Matt Welke. It's the first time I've been in a few years. This year I've been driving for Dave, so I took a tour yesterday, went to Canala, Kerno Brother Wines, O'Leary Walkers, Pike's, and to Seven Hill.
I'm Kate Reldick from Clare.
I'm Collins Campbell from Clare.
This is my first gourmet. It's definitely the good.
I've technically been getting my face painted and dancing and also drinking a lot of lemonade. Like Mummy and Daddy told me not to get sick.
I've been running around on near the dam and also dancing and getting my face painted.
You can toast marshmallows and you can all...
I've definitely been seeking marshmallows.
I kept on burning mine to coal.
Enjoy it, girls. I want to see some more dancing action on the dance floor.
Yes, you definitely will.
And my name is Terry Webb. I'm from Stepney in Adelaide. Oh, so far, it's been fantastic. We actually kicked off yesterday with some friends from Seven Hill, and I think we did five different wineries. But we were behaved. We weren't that bad. But they bailed today, and today we fronted up, and we went to Seven Hill first up, then over to Killiecanoon, and now we're over here.
This is obviously not your first gourmet.
No, we were here for, I think, the very first gourmet. And in fact, inside of Eldridge's office there, there's a picture, a montage picture, which has our photo on it from about 1985 to 86.
So how does gourmet compare to way back then to now then?
Fortunately, not as wild as it used to be. Back in those days, it was very much people would bus from Adelaide, they would get hammered, and then they would go home. We saw so many times when, particularly doctors and nurses' outfits, for example, they'd all dress in white at the beginning of the day. By the end of the day, they were red.
Is there a go-to winery for all of you? Every single time you come up, you say, oh, we need to go back to our staple?
Yeah, definitely Eldridge. Even back in the day when people used to go skinny dipping in the dam at the end of a long day. And they had the boat on the dam for a while there as well. So, yeah, definitely Eldridge.
Do you think there might be skinny dipping today?
Cool, I hope not. Certainly not in my condition.
Jacinta Mala.
So what brings you back? This is the second time you've been to Gourmet. What is it that brings you back again?
Such a good vibe. Everyone's loving it here and we really enjoy it. We have a bus of 60 come down and... yeah, we love it here. We always come back and it's a great vibe, atmosphere, and we love it.
My name is Molly and I'm from Gawler. We've come out with a heap of our football team friends, with the football club, essentially. First Clare Gourmet, yes. It's really fun. I love the vibe. I love the food. The atmosphere is really good. And obviously the fire's keeping me nice and warm. It's great.
I'm Skye. I'm from Port Lincoln originally, but I now live in Adelaide. I'm out here with my football club and netball club as well. I love the scenery out here. It's like nothing else, like all the vineyards and just like the greenery. It's so amazing. Like you don't get that in Adelaide. So I think it's really nice.
I'm Skye Eldridge. I'm from Eldridge Wines. It's been fantastic. A little manic, but it's been really good. All the crowds are in a good mood and they've all been really good fun. Everyone seems to be enjoying themselves and embracing the cold weather. There was a bit of rain yesterday, but it didn't deter anyone, which was lovely. Yeah, I reckon it's our busiest gourmet since pre-COVID. We had double the amount of people through yesterday that we've had in the past few years, and today we've more than hit our cap from last year. It's been really good. We actually sold out of food last night. We thought we had enough for the 2 days and sold it all out in one. We recouped this morning, rewrote the menu, and have actually sold out again today, and we've still got an hour till finish.
Yeah. So what else are you doing as part of Gourmet Week?
On Tuesday night, we've got Wine Under the Stars. So we've got a couple of astrologers coming up from Adelaide with digital telescopes, and they'll show everybody some of the nebulas and galaxies and planets, and then you do a picnic in the vineyard with a bottle of wine. Even though it's going to be cold, we'll have lots of rugs and things. And then on Thursday, we've got School of Wine with Lee. So my dad, Lee, used to teach wine appreciation at TAFE years ago and does like a mini education class. Every year we run that, and it's always, well, lots of people come for it. It's always a really good thing. If it's a small crowd, it's more intimate. A big group, he still works the crowd. He's very good at that. And then next Saturday, we've got the burning of the barrels. So we do a bit of a celebration of the end of vintage and burn a barrel on a really big pile. And that's always good fun too. That's probably the event we most look forward to.
So how has it been with the whole week-long gourmet week now opposed to just the weekend?
I really like it. I think it opens up the whole Clare Valley and to more demographics, to more offerings. We get to do all the blending sessions and the tastings, and it means that staff like me, I get to get around and do a few things this week during the week, which I love too. It means I get to get involved. So no, I think it's brilliant. I think it's really, really good. I hope we keep it. This is the third year we've done the week long, and I think people are just starting to realise we do the week long. So I think people are now staying on those extra days to get more events in, or coming, you know, middle of the week to do next weekend, and even though they're missing the festival weekend. So I think it's actually been really good because people are starting to know now that it is every year. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. You should be so happy. There are people everywhere, and everyone I've spoken to so far are having an absolute blast. There's some people that I've spoken to that every gourmet they come up for, and I think some have been coming since the beginning, They always come to Eldridge's.
Well, Danny Hooper's singing for us for his 27th year. We've been doing gourmet for since 95. We skipped COVID, obviously, so we've done 28 years, and he's done 27 with us, which is amazing. And this year's our first year running the Family Fun Day, which has worked beautifully. So that's been really good. It's something different to offer. It's catered for more people, which has been great. And the kids seem to be having good fun, and my daughter is is in there helping. So she's 10. So she's been helping to run the nature play and also the scavenger hunt. And then we've got face painting happening on the deck. So there's a bit of something for everybody today, which I love.
As Skye did mention, the Breathe It In Gourmet Week is in its third year, but not all of the events involve wine. The Curly Goose, along with Sawmill Gin, offered people a unique experience of a Devonshire G&T. Homemade scones served with jam and treats accompanied with tea and coffee or Clare Valley gins and cocktails in fine bone china. Sophie Whitehead is the mistress of all things food and her husband David is the gin distiller. While on a caravanning holiday around Australia, they both arrived in the Clare Valley and spontaneously bought the Curly Goose and transformed it into a gin and function space. A totally different line of work for David, who used to be an executive with Australia Post, and a more subdued approach for Sophie, who chefed for the rich and famous on super yachts and in mansions in Sydney. Sophie is originally from the UK and she started out in the hospitality industry, cooking for the Queen's mother at Clarence House. She wanted to channel that experience into their first gourmet event.
Being a chef, and I used to cook for the Queen Mother, so I thought that everyone likes a nice scone and some clotted cream and jam, so we thought we'll do that with a gin and tonic instead of a cup of tea. And I've got lots of crockery and a tea set and coffee set and things that the Queen Mother had given me. So we thought we'd pour the gin and tonic from the teapot and serve it in a little teacup instead.
I have never eaten scones with gin before. It wouldn't be something I would mix together, to be honest.
No, but the Queen Mother used to like her own gin, so we thought it would go well together.
Wow, really?
Yes. So we've done a classic scone and a classic gin.
And what's been the response from the people that have turned up this week?
Everyone has loved it, thought it was quirky and fun, and have really enjoyed their afternoon.
How did you end up cooking for the Queen's Mother?
So I grew up in the UK, born in the UK, always wanted to be a chef. From the age of 9, that's what I decided, that's what I wanted to do. So I left school at 16. I searched for the best catering college to go and study at, which I did. I got into it. I had a proper interview and everything, got into that. And it was a 2-year full-time course with chefing and a bit of bar work and waitressing as well, but really loved it and did well at it. And when it was time to leave, the comptroller to the Queen Mother were looking for a cook to work at Clarence House. They contacted the college and then the college recommended me.
Out of everyone there, how many people were going through?
Oh, hundreds. I don't know off the top of my head. I can't remember. It was a long time ago.
And how old were you?
18. And then within 10 days, I had been interviewed. I'd been vetted to make sure that I wasn't part of the IRA, just to make sure all was safe. And then within 10 days, I was living in Clarence House and cooking for the Queen Mother.
Oh, wow. So how are you feeling, firstly, of getting the job in the first place and the responsibility of cooking for royalty?
At first, when I was first told about it, my mum took the phone call, and me being very naive, I said, oh, I'm not going to move up to Scotland and rah, 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 and totally naive. Anyway, it was a living position. Yeah, it was surreal. It was hard to believe that, you know, a few weeks beforehand I was in college with other teenagers, and then the next minute I'm living at Clarence House and cooking not just for her but for her household and any staff or any other royals that came along, cooking for them as well.
What were your go-to dishes for the Queen's Mother?
Well, I started off doing afternoon teas.
Ah.
So I can make you a cucumber sandwich like you've never had a cucumber sandwich before. Tomato sandwiches, but not just you cut a slice of tomato, it's very involved. Doing all the cakes, all the scones, all the biscuits. So any time she decided to invite people over, last minute, I'd had to rush downstairs into the kitchen and start baking.
Wow. So this whole Devonshire tea during Breathe It In Week is a walk in the park for you compared to what you're used to.
And it brings back lots of memories too, so it's really great. It's been fun.
So you started off at afternoon teas and did you progress further?
Okay. Yeah, and she had 100 staff. That included the police as well. Some of the time I was cooking for staff and then most of the time it was for the royals. So then we did breakfasts, and I did her breakfasts and got into trouble with one of her breakfasts. Actually, I've got a letter from her saying, could you please remind the chef that did my breakfast to take my fruit out of the fridge the night before because it's too cold for my teeth. I have that letter. Not quite in those words, but close. One day, once we've got everything out of our boxes, I'll have all the Queen Mother's stuff that I've got.
You need to frame it and put it up on the wall.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. I've been a long way since then.
Well, speaking of coming a long way, how long were you there for?
2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then I decided I wanted to move to Australia.
Did you enjoy that 2.5 years?
Loved it.
Loved it?
It was amazing. We got to travel with her everywhere.
Oh, so where did you go?
On the Queen's flight to Birkhall was her residence, which is just down the road from Balmoral. We stayed at Castle of May, Sandringham, Royal Lodge in Windsor, got on to her Royal Yacht Britannia, her train and the Queen's flight. So wherever they went, we went with her.
Did you meet the Queen?
I met all of them.
Met all of them?
Except for William I fed. He was just in a high chair. I hadn't met Harry or Eugenie. Everybody else I'd met.
Did you meet Princess Di?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
Yes, I did. Beautiful lady. Very funny. Excellent sense of humour. And got to dance with them all.
Really?
Yes, because up in Scotland they have a yearly ball at Balmoral Castle and the staff are invited to that. We were taught, we had to learn all the Scottish dances and would have staff dances and some of the royals would come to that. And Prince Charles, when he was Prince Charles, came along and I danced with him to the Dashing White Sergeant. Yeah. So we had to learn all the dances because when you're dancing in Balmoral Castle in the ballroom, you know Scottish dancing, you move around, you're dancing with different people all the time, so we had to learn it.
Do you reflect back on that time and go, wow, I guess at the time I didn't imagine the enormity of it. I mean, it's quite significant and not many people would get to do what you've done. Do you reflect back and go, oh, wow, that's cool?
Yeah, I do. I used to be embarrassed about talking about it. I wouldn't talk about it to anybody. It would be everybody else, all my friends telling everybody else, not me saying it.
Why were you embarrassed?
I don't know. It was a job. Make it bigger than it was.
Working for the royals, are you a big royalist?
I am. It has changed over the years. And we listen to lots of audiobooks while David and I are travelling and we listen to Spare. I wasn't going to, but I'm really glad I did because I totally get his side of things because I've seen that side of things, not just what everybody else sees. I've seen behind the scenes, so I totally understand where he's coming from.
So you came to Australia. What did you do in Australia to follow on from cooking for the Queen's mother?
I did work just for a couple of weeks at the Opera House. And then I got a job up at Centrepoint Tower and worked in the a la carte restaurant there for a year and then backpacked around Australia for another year. Every time I ran out of money, I'd just get another chef job. So then I backpacked around Australia for a year. So I worked on Hamilton Island, up in Darwin. I was part of SOCOG, the Sydney Olympic Committee. I looked after them. I've worked in 5-star hotels. I've had my own business. Restaurants, cafes, consulting, and everything in between.
And the references you would have got would have been quite significant coming from royalty. So I presume no matter where you went, you would have got a job.
Yes.
I can imagine that would have set you up for life, would you say?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I understand that you started cooking for the rich and famous in Sydney. How did that come to be?
For the last 6 years before we started travelling, there's a lady who's got a company called Sides and Main and it's her own business and it was just her and I. We would work on super yachts and mansions in the eastern suburbs of Sydney and she has a really good business model and we just worked really well together. And she was very particular about her food and, yeah, it just worked really well. And
so you did private dinners?
Private dinners, mm-hmm. Ladies' luncheons, weddings, parties. We did Brian Brown's daughter's wedding. That was on Cockatoo Island. They hired the whole island for her wedding. that was pretty amazing.
What was it like dealing with those super wealthy people? Were they easy to deal with?
Depends. You get all sorts all the time. The wealthy people that had made their own money were beautiful and down to earth. The ones that had inherited it and they weren't so easy to work with. But, yeah, money was no object. So we had amazing ingredients to work with. And
I presume when it comes to that type of work, the expectations are exceedingly high. And did you ever find that you couldn't reach their expectations, or were there things that you had to say no to because it was just beyond anyone's capability? I mean, what in that type of environment, I can imagine it would be quite stressful.
Yes, it could have been stressful, particularly when we had to go on some of the super yachts, teeing up the timing of getting everything on there before everybody started arriving, working in a small galley, so you had to be really organised. But those expectations were a challenge, so it was fun.
Yeah.
That nothing was too hard. We'd work away it. We'd work away to get exactly what they wanted so they were happy.
So, Sophie, how did you end up from that to the Clare Valley?
Well, David, my husband, he used to be an exec for Australia Post. Worked for them for 32 years, and through COVID and floods and fires and everything else that was going on in around that same time in New South Wales, it's just too stressful. And he said, what am I doing this for? So just decided to leave, and we decided we wanted to rent our house out and get a caravan, four-wheel drive, and travel Australia.
And you were happy to leave?
It was good. The hardest thing is the children, leaving them behind, and friends, but they're always there. So they can come here, we can go there, and we can still catch up. So we were going to travel for 2 or 3 years, and got to about 5 months when we arrived in Clare.
Had you been to Clare before?
No.
So what was it about Clare that made you stay?
Well, this opportunity came up. So we were with our self-managed super fund. We wanted to find something. We didn't know where, and we didn't know what it looked like. We just left it to the universe to see what happened. And we arrived in Clare. We went to the real estate and just had a chat with them. And they told us about the Curly Goose and that it could be coming on the market soon. And they asked us if we'd have a look at it, which we did. And
with the vision of making gin, or did that come later?
It needed different income streams, so I was going to use my chefing somewhere. We've got the vines. David's amazingly handy, so he's turned the old cellar door into an Airbnb, so that would be another income stream. It just ticked so many boxes. Then we carried on traveling and realized, my goodness, we've just bought a vineyard.
Did it do something with it?
Yes. We had, like, David's creative, like I said, and he's a massive researcher, so had learned how to make gin before making gin, and then when we got here, started making gin.
Oh, so he's the one behind the gin?
Yeah.
Ah.
He's the gin man.
He's the gin man.
Yes. We work well together.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and then he went to uni for a week to get the piece of paper and learn a little bit more. It's taken off.
And what does the children think of your new endeavours?
They've come to terms with it now. Poor Hannah, my daughter, she was the youngest out of our five. She was still living with us and she thought we were being very selfish and didn't think about her, and we were making her move out and it was not fair.
How old is she?
21. So I said, you're 21, not 17. And I'd come to Australia when I was 20, and we wouldn't have even thought about it if we didn't think she was capable of living on her own. So she's grown up immensely since we've done this, and I miss them like crazy. They miss me, but we get to see them and travel, and they get to come down here as well.
And with your chefing experience and being exposed to so many different things in Sydney and your experience in the UK, I mean, how well does the Clare Valley do their thing? do the food, do the wine. Is it good, or is there room for improvement?
There's room for improvement in the fact of suppliers. I've really found it hard because obviously Sydney, you can get everything and anything. I can order any fruit or vegetable I like, any type of meat, any type of cut, all those things, and that's been challenging.
Even to order from Adelaide?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, and going down to the markets is still things that they don't have, and having to adapt to that has been interesting.
You've just been spoilt, Sophie.
I know.
You've got to come to how the little people live.
Yeah, that's right, off the land. But generally, like when we came, we didn't know how the reception would be, being city slickers and then coming into Little Clare. But we've been blown away by everyone's warmth and support, and it just feels like a big hug, really, that everyone's just... It just feels amazing. We've really had a good reception. They do the wine well. They do the food well. There's other things that obviously I'd like to see in Clare.
What would you like to see?
Things to be open past 2 o'clock, or that more places for people to go. So if
on a weekend,
visitors, yeah, yep. Visitors come here. There's not much to do in the afternoon. So then I feel that we could be losing people from staying here longer.
With all that experience behind you, what's a piece of advice that you could give to those people that want to get into hospitality and do something similar to what you've done?
Stick with it. If it's really your passion and you wake up every morning and you're prepared to put in the hard yards, because it's hard work and long hours and unsociable hours. If you're willing to do that and you're passionate enough to stick with it and just be open to what is, you know, presented to you, what the universe gives you, and just go with it.
Well, Sophie, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat to me, and good luck here in the Clare Valley. We are so lucky to have you here and have your experience, and the fact that coming with new ideas, which I think everyone within the industry and in the community will appreciate. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Annabelle, for having me. And it's been fun.
Sophie Whitehead from the Curly Goose and Sawmill Gin at Seven Hill. They are open to functions. They conduct gin making workshops, gin tastings, and they're in the throes of organising an annual gin festival called A Gin Thing, inviting gin distillers from across South Australia to set up on the lawns at the Curly Goose and get you to sample the best of the best in South Australia. So mark September the 16th on your calendars. That's a wrap of the latest episode of the Clare Valley Podcast. If there's anything you'd like addressed on this podcast, please get in touch. In the meantime, to keep on top of the latest council happenings, head to the website or the social media pages. This podcast is proudly brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. I'm Annabelle Homer. I'll catch you next time.